a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So how do we make a prosperous America? How do we make individual prosperity? Where does wealth come from? How does it all work? In just a second, we'll be talking with Daniel Merrick about Republican economic policies. He has a new book out. Also in the program, in the third hour of our program, Alec Dubrow from the International Labor Communications Association will be with us, and Clara Jeffrey from Mother Jones Magazine. An awful lot in the news as well. The sellout of habeas corpus continues in the Senate. A fundamental human right that was first put in place in 1215 on a plane in Runnymede in the UK, off just near the River Thames. The idea enshrined in our Constitution, in the 4th through the 8th Amendments, that you can't be put into jail without being charged with a crime and having some access to due process. We're seeing, tragically, John McCain, John Warner, selling out their principles. Just no other way to say it, just selling out their principles. The first time in the history of the United States. Well, actually, let me amend that. This, along with Franklin Roosevelt's shameful internment of the Japanese. But, I mean, even Abe Lincoln went to Congress, complying with the Constitution, and asked for a specific, temporary set-aside of habeas corpus. But anyway, we'll get into all that stuff and more, and Bill Clinton smacked down on Fox News yesterday. Fascinating. In just a moment, Daniel Merrick is with us. He is the author of a book, Instructions to Money, From Welfare to Millionaire, a book heavily laced, Daniel. I think that you're actually quite proud of it, with essentially Republican and conservative and you applaud Pat Robertson, Christian ideals throughout the book, although I call myself a Christian, and I find some of these a little spooky. But welcome to our program.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
The website for Daniel Merrick's book, by the way, is rdjcatalog.com. Daniel, you say tax cuts actually increase revenue and lead to job growth.
Yes, definitely. You can see the best example in actual practical experience right now in the city of Buffalo, New York. Buffalo, New York's been struggling with decreasing taxes and problems with revenues. So their answer was to increase revenues to raise taxes. Well, a lot of businesses moved out. I mean, it's just simple mathematics. If you take and tax a dollar at 9% versus $100 at 7%, you're going to have 9 cents versus $7. So you earn more money. And it actually empowers the small business person like myself, who came off of welfare, to actually do something with that extra money that they have. And it allows for a lot of the benevolent and social welfare programs, which you may find amazing, that I actually support.
Daniel, how is it that a country, $8 trillion in debt, In that context, in the context of an $8 trillion debt, $3 trillion of that run up just since George Bush came into office, how is it that you could characterize any reduction in taxation, which is compensated for by an increase in borrowing, as a tax cut? These are not tax cuts. These are welfare payments to the ultra-rich at the expense of you and me and our children. We're going to, this year, spend $300 billion in interest payments just on money borrowed by two presidents, George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. Those two presidents borrowed, between the two of them, about $5.5-6 trillion in order to make the economy look good and in order to get themselves reelected. We're going to pay $300 billion in interest on that. That's enough to give 15 million Americans full four-year college scholarships. How can you characterize that as a tax cut?
Well, I don't really defend the raising any taxation or any debt. What I advocate in my book is actually a program that's based on empowering the poor, empowering the small business person, the home business person, the little guy, to help him get off of welfare, get off of taxation problems, and go into business for themselves.
Then why do you support Republican economic policies that work to the benefit of large multinational corporations and screw small companies?
I remember, Tom, when I was working in a restaurant as a high school kid under the Carter administration, taxation was at 73%, and I was poor. I was making about $250 a week. I only took home like $90. I mean, the taxation was on me, on my back. The poor guy. What I'm talking
Daniel, stop for just a second here.
Economic
policy. Daniel, are you trying to tell me that you were paying 73% income tax rate on a $250 a month salary or
yes,
a week salary?
Yes, I was.
Then you had the wrong CPA, Daniel. I'm sorry, because that tax rate didn't kick in until you were making well over $500,000 a year.
Had 26% interest rates, and the only job I had, I was in high school part-time at a restaurant.
You were not paying 73% tax rate.
High school, yes, I was. It was 73% of my check. I was in the state of Ohio. I got the pay stubs to prove it.
Oh, you're talking about the total?
Yeah, as a total tax rate that I was paying. They were taking all that money.
Okay, so here's the question, Dan.
I was poor. My mom was working a job to supplement income because we didn't have the income coming into the house.
Here's
the
question.
We couldn't afford it.
Here's the question. So that tax money was going to pay for public education. It was going to pay for schools. It was going to pay for the police who were protecting you. It was going to pay for, you know, and
my pay was going to pay for the one meal a day, two meals
right.
a day I got to eat.
That's right. Now,
as
do you
a
think,
child
Daniel,
in the inner city and a
do you think,
black
Daniel, if
as a Democrat at the time,
do you think, Daniel, that if the tax rate, if your tax rate had gone to zero, and therefore you were able to keep 100% of the money that you were being paid, that your employer at that burger stand would not have cut your pay by 70% because they knew that you were willing to work for the same take-home pay?
I think that that corporation at that point
they'd be nuts now.
Would have given me my full paycheck.
No, they wouldn't.
Yes, they would.
No, they wouldn't, because they knew that you would work for it. Let's say you were making $3 an hour and you were taking home a buck, okay, just to make it simple. They now know that you will work for a dollar an hour in your pocket at the end of the day. All of a sudden, the tax law changes, and so instead of paying you $3 an hour and have $2 of it go to the government, they can now pay you $1 an hour because you're still ending up with $1 an hour.
At the same time, Tom, if you read my book, you realize, you know, when I talk about zero coupon bond funding, which a lot of the Republicans and the Democrats refuse to look at that. That's how a lot of big economies in the world support their economy, by getting backing from large banks and large financial institutions to help make loans that self-liquidate and finance a lot of the projects that you're talking about you want to fund.
Well, the problem is we no longer have that option in the United States because Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush have run this country so far into debt that every time a baby is born in the United States, they're born with a $29,000 debt. And that's not including future interest.
Why, you know, Tom, I don't believe that the original Republican economic policies, the thing that I'm talking about in my book, empowering entrepreneurs, individuals, to own their own business, to own the means of production for themselves, is a anti-Democrat or anti-Ronald Reagan or anti-Bush sort of concept. That concept is basically a concept that says, like I said in Buffalo, New York, they want to charge 9 cents taxes on $1 revenue as opposed to $7 taxes.
Buffalo, New York is confronted with the horrible situation that because of the disastrous trade policies first advocated by Richard Nixon, then followed through on by Ronald Reagan, then George W. Bush, and then enshrined by Bill Clinton, and now being pushed even further by George W. Bush.
Well,
because of those economic policies, they're losing their manufacturing jobs, but they still have infrastructure they have to pay for.
What about what George Soros promotes, which is basically just let's all give up and go to communism? My wife is a Ukrainian.
George
immigrant.
Soros has never
he
suggested communism, and I've been in countries that were communist. I'm right there with you.
My
it
wife
doesn't
lived
work.
Under a communist empire. You know what happens under it? You get
yes, I know what happens under it.
Government taking everything out of a person's.
Paycheck. I am not advocating communism, Daniel Merrick. I'm a capitalist, just like you. What I'm saying is that you have bought a bill of goods. Ronald Reagan was not acting in the interest of people like you and me who are small businessmen. He was acting in the interest of the big oil companies, the big multinational corporations.
No, when I originally met Mr. Reagan, I met him down in Charlotte, North Carolina at an Amway convention. And that Amway convention, he talked about empowering the entrepreneur, empowering the individual, reducing the tax rate, and increasing the revenue.
I know, and you bought it. And what he did was he didn't reduce your tax rate. You're paying $300 billion this year on interest on the money that he borrowed so that you could think that he was reducing your tax rate. He lied to you and you bought it.
Well, for 63 years, the Democrats controlled the Congress and the Senate, and they didn't do anything about it.
They didn't raise the budget deficit like that. Daniel Merrick, you can find out all about his book over at his website, rdjcatalog.com.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, time to throw the rascals out. 21 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program, talk radio for the rest of us. Mike Whitehouse in today's Wall Street Journal. Over the past several years, Americans and their government enjoyed one of the best deals in international finance. We borrowed trillions of dollars from abroad to buy flat panel TVs, build homes, and fight wars. But as those borrowings mounted, the nation's payments on its net foreign debt barely budged. Now, however, the easy money is coming to an end. So much so that for the first time in at least 90 years, that is, as in since the Great Depression, or just before, the U.S. is paying noticeably more to its foreign creditors than it receives from its investments abroad. In other words, the U.S. is becoming poorer as a result of the policies of Bush, Reagan, and Clinton. And Daniel Merrick on the line, Instructions to Money, From Welfare to Millionaire, his book, his website, instructionstomoney.net. Daniel, we have hard breaks in this program. The music starts and we got to stop talking. And you weren't finished, so welcome back. You were in midpoint, as I recall.
Well, the only thing else I would like to say, Tom, to the listeners is, you know, one of the people that we work with, Sarian Bama, is a welfare to millionaire story. Also, she's an immigrant from the Washington Baltimore area, and she's a Democrat, and we work together on a project called Welfare, the number 2, millionaire.tv.com, to try to teach and mentor people who are on welfare how to get off welfare, how to empower themselves, not to become what I call in my book indentured servant to a large corporation, as you would look at it, or a slave to a corporation for a dollarly wage, but to get their own business and build their net worth over $1 million.
Well, I think it's a fine thing, and I'm all in favor of people doing well. And my position has always been that the best welfare program is a job. I think that the idea that the employer of last resort should and could be the government, as Franklin Roosevelt did with the WPA and the CCC during really serious hard times, is a good idea.
My father, Robert Merrick, who helped the beginning concepts to found my company, RDG Catalog, worked in the camps, the WCC camps, and he also fought for unions at 3M Corporation, Division Bailey Meter in Cleveland, Ohio.
Then having benefited from that, how can you, so throughout your book, and I've spent some time with your book here, throughout your book, you are basically not just, kissing up to the right, but saying, they're the salvation of America, this is the only way to go, the Democrats are going to get you, they're evil communists, I don't get it. There's a dissonance here. From welfare to millionaire. If there wasn't welfare, you would have been what? Homeless, dead by now.
Possibly, but see, I don't advocate the ending of those social welfare programs. I believe in an entrepreneurial capitalistic method by which the best form of sharing the wealth is a capitalistic entrepreneurial group that makes enough to contribute to that type of program. But
Well, I think there's a certain level of agreement between the two of us that a rising tide lifts all boats, but that small reality has been turned into a big lie in a huge way by
Well, you have a lot of Republicans right now that are very upset that that we have that debt that you're stressing, that trillions of dollars of debt, and I don't disagree with necessarily Bush going into Iraq and saving all those Kurds' lives and such like that, because Saddam was a dictator and he killed a lot of people. Sure, we were all lied to about a lot of things by all political parties. And I think that the people of America need to be more empowered themselves with the finances and the support so that they don't have too much month left at the end of the money. Therefore, you know, I have Democrat friends that are just as upset with certain Democratic policies as Republican friends that are upset with the Republican policies. We need to find true leadership in America.
You suggest in your book that the death tax, you call the inheritance tax, is a disaster for our economy. Now, we have a minute here before the music is going to start, and they are going to cut us off. I don't get it. Why should you care about a tax that hits one-tenth of one? Why should Paris Hilton... You know, why should you be so concerned about Paris Hilton getting a tax break?
I'm not concerned about Paris Hilton getting a tax break. I'm concerned about my seven kids. And I'm concerned that I have $50,000 a year for each of those seven kids in college.
So you have a net worth that exceeds $4 million?
And my chances of me maybe living to see my last kid finish college is nil. In Pennsylvania, the death tax is going to take about 53% of everything that I would pass on to my children, which would leave me virtually nothing left for my children. We're talking
so
about
why not adjust that tax?
To go to college.
Why not adjust that tax? Well, that's a whole other issue. I mean, we should be investing in public education, but why not adjust that tax so it no longer hits the high end of the middle class and once again goes back to the way it was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and really is only hitting the very wealthy?
Say that again?
Why not raise the threshold for the inheritance tax to say it starts at $20 million instead of $4 million?
Well, that would be a great idea.
Okay, all righty. I guess we've achieved
now
some consensus.
Now get both parties
here.
To agree on it.
Yeah, good luck. The good book, luck. Instructions to Money, From Welfare to Millionaire, Daniel W. Merrick, Ph.D. The website, instructionstomoney.net. Good talking with you, Daniel. Thanks for being with us. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Fashion for the warriors whose strength is not defined. Fashion for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gaze upon the shines of freedom flashing.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on Listener Supported Radio, supported by our listeners supporting our sponsors. Be sure to support our local sponsors that you hear on your local radio station, and also our national sponsors. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPod now, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com, their website, and Sacred Grounds Coffee. All organic, all fair trade, and some incredibly delicious stuff. This program powered by Sacred Grounds Coffee. Saving the planet one cup at a time. 1-800-425-2532. 1-800-425-2532 or sacredgroundscoffee.com. My comment about the inheritance tax as we were going out was that the whole point of the inheritance tax from the founding of this country, and yes, I realize it wasn't in place in the founding of this country. It came and went at various times throughout the history of this country. But Teddy Roosevelt was in favor of it. Thomas Jefferson was in favor of it. The idea of the inheritance tax was that we don't want to have a landed gentry in the United States. We don't want to have huge dynasties that have such political power that they can influence the nation. The phrase that Jefferson used was overgrown wealth that represents a threat to a republic. I mean, it's just that simple. And therefore, we say, you know, yeah, it's fine if you accumulate a lot of money, enough money that you and your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren never have to work. But there's a limit. And the Walton family, who made $8 billion last year just sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive and paid a maximum 15% income tax on it. The Walton, certain members of the Walton family have been funding this stealth program over the last decade to change the lexicon, the American lexicon, from inheritance tax to death tax. And the fact of the matter is the inheritance tax right now is I believe, fixed at around $2 million per person, or it's going to go up to that perhaps either this year or next year. I don't qualify, so I don't keep super close track of it, but anyhow, it's in that neighborhood. And it's going to go up to $4 million for a married couple. And, you know, the reality is that that's not a mind-boggling amount of money like it was in 1950. I mean, in 1950, $4 million was like $40 million in today's money. That's how much our dollar has devalued since that time. I mean, literally. Go back and look at the value of a house in 1950. In 1950, you could buy a nice house in the United States for $15,000. That same house right now will sell for $150,000, $200,000. My suggestion was if a middle-class house in some communities in the United States, in San Francisco, for example, or in some more expensive urban areas in Manhattan, if just a 1,500-square-foot apartment is going to cost $1 million and people have to live there and you want families living there and communities living there, then let's just raise the threshold on that inheritance tax from the $2 million that it is right now up to maybe 4 or 10 or 20 or whatever. Not a whole lot beyond 20, I would suggest, but because at that point, future generations' ability to live the life of leisure is pretty much secured. But let's leave it intact for the billionaires and the multi-billionaires. But that's not the agenda of the Grover Norquist of the world. They buy into this bizarre notion that wealth somehow creates jobs. No, I'm sorry, it's not. Demand ultimately creates jobs, and that the economy just springs into being because some wealthy person decides to build a factory. You know, it's like, you know, Bush running around going, yeah, we're going to give all these tax cuts to all these people, you know, $500,000 a person to these wealthy folks, and with that $500,000, they'll create one job. They'll build a factory someplace and create one job. Yes, indeed, they did. In China, in Mexico. I mean, it's fiscal insanity. It's just plain old fiscal insanity. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenny, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to say they got this whole thing just backwards, man. I mean, you figure it. If you need a certain amount of money to keep the government going, and you keep eliminating jobs in the same process, that's like increasing taxes automatically on the rest of people that's working trying to support the system, that the amount of money that you need.
Right, and the other way they do that is by inflation, by devaluing the value of the dollar and causing people to go up into higher and higher tax brackets and thus creeping into higher and higher, you know, paying more taxes and creeping into higher tax brackets. Inflation is a very, very insidious way of taxing the middle class progressively more and more. And thus producing screams of outrage about, hey, stop taxing us so much, which then are cured by reducing the taxes on millionaires and billionaires.
Well, then you keep increasing it by taking out, if you're not going to increase taxes to try to pay the debt off, and you want to cut taxes on top of that while you're still outsourcing, you accumulate this debt, and then if you're not going to raise taxes to pay the debt, then you've got to start selling off your infrastructure because...
Yeah.
You still need a certain amount of money to function.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Kenny. And what you've highlighted, and thank you for the call, what you've highlighted is just, you know, the total and general insanity of this whole of conservative economics, basically. The Wall Street Journal, Mark Whitehouse, today, in today's Wall Street Journal, U.S. foreign debt shows its teeth as rates climb. It's the number one story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. In effect, the U.S. made a quarterly debt payment of about $22 for each American household, he notes. This in the last quarter. Now, this is the opposite. He says, a turnaround from the $31 net investment income per household that it received a year earlier. In other words, it was that people were investing in the United States. Now, not only are they not investing in the United States so much, but they're saying, hey, pay us back the money you owe us. You know, Reagan borrowed all that money. Time to pay it back. Bush Sr. borrowed all that money. Time to pay it back. Clinton, early years, he had to borrow money. You get Republicans in Congress driving this stuff. Pay it back. And Georgie, come on, pay some of it back. As Mark Whitehouse says, in years to come, a growing share of whatever prosperity the nation achieves probably will be sent abroad in the form of debt service payments. That means Americans will have to work harder to maintain the same limited standards or cut back sharply to pay down the debt. This is the result of Reaganomics. Pure and simple. Ronald Reagan, whether out of stupidity, and frankly I think it was, I think that he himself just didn't understand economics and he bought into the simplistic rhetoric. But the people who were driving this process, they understood economics very well. And they're making out like bandits out of this thing. Ronald Reagan sold us down the tubes. As Catherine Mann, a senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics, said, it's as if on our personal MasterCards we've run up large obligations and never had to make payments. You can't believe it's going to last forever. And then the really scary stuff. And this is from an article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today. If the trend persists, it could also raise concerns about the nation's creditworthiness, putting pressure on the U.S. currency. Now, if our dollar starts to fall, we all become dramatically poorer. And if it falls really fast and they try to inflate our way out of it, we're back. We're looking at a situation like Weimar Germany was in the 1920s. I mean, this could be the big one. Goldman Sachs chief economist Jim O'Neill, he says economists have been warning about this for so long that people have gotten bored, but now we're starting to see the deterioration. The stuff that I've been ranting about for 4 years on this radio program, it, according to the Wall Street Journal, today, this year, first time, starting to come home to roost. The nation's consumption, investment, and other outlays have exceeded income by a cumulative $2.9 trillion, the largest gap on record in the history of the United States. The current account deficit contributes directly to the nation's total foreign debt, the value of all U.S. stocks, bonds, real estate, businesses, and other assets owned by non-U.S. residents. At the end of 2009, total U.S. foreign debt stood at $13.6 trillion, or $119,000 per household. That's foreign debt. $119,000 per household. And the foreigners are now saying, time to pay it back. Matt in Sacramento. Hey, Matt, thanks for calling. What's up?
Oh, I really loved your last caller. Put in working man's language.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, what do we have colleges for? Anyway, so I really got to bring up something that Reagan said when he was running for office and I was a young man. And he said that, look at this graph here. You owe $1 trillion because of the Democrats. Remember that?
Yeah.
National TV.
You're talking, this was 1982?
80.
In 1980. Yeah, that's right, the election of 80.
Yeah, right. And so I watched that as a young person and thought, we got to vote for this guy, and I did. Now, here's the betrayal of the country and the betrayal of Jefferson, Washington, everybody else who created it, and all the people in World War II who died for it. The betrayal is he got in there and ran up that debt and did exactly what everybody's saying. He said, look how rich you are, and he was borrowing our money. Now, that now is, like you say, coming home to roost. You know the $200 billion accounts deficit in our trade last quarter. Yeah. And so the point is, and I'm talking to young people. I talked to a 16-year-old girl, and she goes, well, that doesn't affect me. And I pointed out to her, I handed her my American Express card. I said, here, it's got a $30,000 limit on it. She goes, what? I said, yeah, it's yours. I said, the problem is it's maxed out, and you owe the interest every month, you idiot.
Yeah, there you are.
God bless. Bye.
Thanks a lot, Matt. I mean, that's where we're at. That is really, you know, well said, Matt. That is where we're at. Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, to his credit, tried to do something about it and actually did, and then George W. Bush. We are flat broke, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Breaking rocks in a hot sun. I'm on the law in a
Welcome back to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Just a reminder for our listeners in the Los Angeles area, Southern California, on Saturday, this Saturday, I'll be at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena at 4 p.m., signing Scrooge, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And at 8 p.m. on Saturday, I'll be in Hollywood at the Bodhi Tree on Melrose Avenue. So Roman's Bookstore, 4 p.m. Pasadena, Bodhi Tree, 8 p.m. Hollywood, Saturday, September 30th.
Get Scrooge by Tom Hartman.
Yeah, that book. That's right. There you go. Thank you, Alex, I think. Bill in Indian River, Michigan. Hey, Bill, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Well, I got screwed by Ronald Reagan, and I'll tell you how.
Okay.
We had a little inheritance, and we wanted to put it away for our kids for college. And so we bought zero coupon bonds, and we were locked in to 12.75%, which was a great deal.
Yeah.
And then Reagan went ahead and changed the rules, because when we bought them, they were taxed at the kids' tax rate.
Right.
You change the rules to make them taxed at our tax rate.
Right.
Well, we were buying a house, and we couldn't afford to pay the tax on the growing interest on the money, so we had to sell it.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just another example of, I mean, you know, Reagan jiggered and rejiggered the tax laws over and over again to favor multimillionaires and billionaires and basically screw the middle class.
Yeah, and that's what he did to me.
Yeah, well, that's a good example of it. Bill, thanks for the tip. And then he based the whole thing on a lie. I mean, you'll recall, and they're continuing to do this. Speaking of lies, in the next hour we're gonna get into Bill Clinton on Fox News this weekend. Boy. Chris Wallace caught in a lie. Talk about Fox News caught in a lie. But in any case, here, just to wrap up the economics end of this thing. The cons have been saying forever, from the mid-1930s, actually it was the late 1930s, leading up to World War II, when Franklin Roosevelt raised the top marginal tax rate to 90%. Now, you didn't start paying that 90% until you were making what in today's dollars would be the equivalent of more than $10 million a year. And you only paid it on the money over that. In other words, your first $100,000 or your first $50,000 is pretty much tax-free. Your next $50,000, $60,000, you were paying $10,000, $15,000, you know, and it went up like that gradually. But the top marginal tax rate for multimillionaires and billionaires was 90%. And Jack Kennedy came along in 1960 and said, let's increase taxes on the corporations and the very wealthy. We're going to close a whole bunch of loopholes, particularly those that have to do with capital gains and those that have to do with the way that companies expense things out, like, you know, the three martini lunch. We're going to close those loopholes. And to kind of sweeten the pot, we'll reduce the top rate from 90% down to 70%. But it's a tax increase. It's going to gain revenue. Well, here's Kennedy talking about it.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
So there it is. I mean, he's just laying it right out and just saying it right up front. We're going to gain. We're going to increase taxes. And, you know, the cons ever since have been saying, well, Kennedy cut the top rate from 90 to 70% and it increased the amount of revenue that came in. Well, yeah, it did, because he increased taxes. And what was he going to do with that? Well, he was pretty unambiguous about it, and he was also upset about the fact that even then Nixon was distorting his numbers.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon mistakes my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
And what a shame that all those years of you know, Reagan running around and trashing government, you know.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah, the trashing government, running on a campaign of trashing government, and what came out of it? The absolute economic devastation. It sure looked good for those 8 years when Reagan was borrowing like crazy and dumping that money into the U.S. economy, spending it on Star Wars and helping his billionaire buddies get rich. And, yeah, some of it was slopping over. But now the bill is coming due. Front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Quoting Noriel Rubini, chairman of Rubini Global Economics, your standard of living is going to be reduced unless you work much harder. They go on to say this, quoting from the Wall Street Journal, among economists' biggest concern is the fast pace at which the U.S. is accumulating new debt. They note foreigners' willingness to lend at low rates has also encouraged Americans and their governments to borrow and spend. By buying U.S. treasuries, foreign investors put up more than four-fifths of the $1.3 trillion the federal government has borrowed since 2001 to help pay for tax breaks, the new Medicare prescription drug benefit, and wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Four-fifths coming from overseas. What happens when they say, no, we're not going to give you any more? That would be even worse than they're saying we want to be repaid, which is what they're starting to say right now. We have to get these insane borrow-and-spend cons out of Congress and get in some people with some fiscal responsibility as soon as possible. And that means getting politically active. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Amazing what's going on in the world here today. The National Intelligence Estimate, this new National Intelligence Estimate from the U.S. government, from the federal government, National Intelligence Estimate, the government of the United States, comes out and says, well, turns out we are creating more terrorists than we are killing. Which is, you know, remember Rumsfeld's kind of, you know, musing email way back when, got a little bit of publicity for a brief way. Now, is it possible to have a metric to determine whether we're creating more terrorists or killing more terrorists? Well, the answer's in. 16 different spy agencies inside the U.S. government. I didn't even know there were 16. So you got the CIA, you got the NSA, you've got the Defense Intelligence Agency, you have Naval Intelligence. Presumably there's Army, Air Force, and Marine Intelligence, I'm assuming. What is that, eight? There's twice as many. In any case, 16 different spy agencies inside the government came up with a consensus. Now, you realize consensus means nobody is disagreeing with it. This was completed in April. It is now September. My guess is the Bushies would have kept the lid on this even longer than this. Somehow this thing got leaked. Somebody said, okay, you know, that they were probably trying to hold it until after the election. It's titled Trends in Global Terrorism, Implications for the United States. And as Mark Mazzetti notes in the New York Times, the American invasion and occupation of Iraq, this is the conclusion of the new classified National Intelligence Estimate. The American invasion and occupation of Iraq has helped spawn a new generation of Islamic radicalism, and the overall terrorist threat has grown since the September 11 attacks. And why has it grown? It has grown because of the insane response to 9/11 by Bush and Cheney. We had the world with us. We could have been talking about, we could have used that. If we had had a real statesman as a president rather than a bully and a punk. And I realize it is something that not only do I feel very uncomfortable about doing, but wouldn't encourage any talk show host to do, to speak ill of the President of the United States in a way that is just, you know, offhand slap. But I lack any other word to describe our foreign policy and the response that Bush and Cheney have brought to 9/11. We could have responded like statesmen. We could have surgically taken out Osama bin Laden. He had at that point in time, at the most, 20,000 people, and according to the best intelligence estimates, 5,000 people who thought he was a cool guy and were loyal to him. He was largely unknown in the Muslim world. Now, he didn't want it that way. He wanted to be the next Saladin. He wanted to be a big shot. Do you see people all around the world with T-shirts on that say, you know, I'm in favor of the blind sheikh, the guy who's rotting in prison right now for the first bombing of the World Trade Center because Bill Clinton tracked him down and prosecuted him for a criminal act? Somehow I don't think so. Do you see people around the world wearing T-shirts that say, I like Tim McVeigh, he's my hero? No. Because Clinton tracked him down and said, you know, this guy is a sicko, he's a wacko, he's a criminal, he's a murderer, a mass murderer. But Bush had to create a superhero in bin Laden so that he himself could become a superhero. He had to create a super anti-hero. And in the process of doing that, in the process of polarizing the world, rather than pulling the world together, George Bush has created a more dangerous world. And frankly, if you go back to John Dean's book, his new book about conservatives, he points out that that is exactly what Bush wanted to do. He wanted to create a world that is more dangerous and more hostile because that helps him hold on to power. Because he's using an authoritarian worldview and an authoritarian mindset to promote that kind of fear. And hold on to power thus. I mean, Tim Russert confronts Dick Cheney. This was a couple of weeks ago on Meet the Press with a poll that says that the majority of Americans think what the 16 intelligence agencies of the United States have now, it's been leaked, but now we know since April, have agreed in consensus. Here it is.
Here's what the American people said in a recent poll. Is the U.S. involvement in Iraq or Afghanistan creating more terrorists or eliminating terrorists? And look at that. Overwhelmingly, 54%, clear majority, believe we are creating more terrorists.
I can't buy that.
I can't buy that. I mean, this is his response. This is all he has. Well, that, of course. And
you don't know the power of the dark side.
Yeah, well, so much from Mr. Cheney. Now, what could we have done? It turns out, I didn't even know this. I mean, I guess I knew it, but I didn't know it. You know, it's one of those things like, you know, I remember when the 9/11 report came out, and I didn't read every word in the book, I'll confess. But, you know, I read a good chunk of it, and as I think many Americans did, and certainly there were a lot of good summaries here and there. One of the points that was made, and it's no secret, although I guarantee you anybody who listens to right-wing talk radio and watches Fox News did not know this, that the USS Cole was bombed by Osama bin Laden in October of 2000. Now, that was about 6 weeks, 8 weeks before the presidential election. In November of 2000. During that period of time, the Republicans were still criticizing Bill Clinton for going after Osama bin Laden in Somalia. Remember, oh, he just blew up an aspirin factory. He's trying to wag the moniker. And when he tried, and you know, there were several operations that Bill Clinton launched against Osama bin Laden, and every single one of them was soundly criticized by the Republicans. Black Hawk Down. The Republicans wanted him to pull our troops out of there immediately. The next day, he took 6 months to orderly bring those people out so that we didn't lose more soldiers. And now they're going back and criticizing him, saying, bin Laden looked at that and said, gee, America's a bunch of wimps. Well, they don't point out that when Hezbollah bombed the U.S. troops in Lebanon, Reagan pulled our soldiers out. I mean, if you want to find things that maybe bin Laden could look at and say, the U.S. doesn't always follow through, wouldn't that make more sense? I mean, that was actually soldiers. We were part of a U.N. peacekeeping force in Somalia, protecting one group of Islamic warlords from another group of Islamic warlords. But here's where it gets truly bizarre. In October of 2000, the USS Cole is bombed. Bill Clinton thinks it's Osama bin Laden. He pulls together the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He says, put together a military plan to go hit, to take out Osama bin Laden. We've been trying to kill this guy. Now we have a good excuse. Let's invade Afghanistan and grab his butt and bring him before a world court and try him for war crimes. Try him for blowing up the USS Cole. Let's get him. And had that happened, it might have prevented 9/11 from happening. Now, there are some who argue it wouldn't have because the planning was already underway. Who knows? It might have blown the whole thing wide open. And the Joint Chiefs said, cool, we'll put together the plan. And they did. And Clinton was ready to go into Afghanistan. And the Republicans were going, he's going to go into Afghanistan. He's trying to wag the moniker. And the only thing he was waiting for before he could go into Afghanistan was the CIA and the FBI signing off on the fact that it was actually bin Laden who blew up the USS Cole. Well, they didn't sign off on that until January of 2001, about three months later. And who was president in January of 2001? George W. Bush. So George W. Bush comes into office. The CIA and the FBI say, hey, guess what? We just figured out it was bin Laden who blew up the USS Cole. And from January of 2001 until September of 2001, what does George W. Bush do about that new piece of intelligence? Absolutely nothing. And has he been questioned about it on Fox ever? No. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It seems like a reasonable time. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Arianna Huffington this morning, nailing it. Let me just set this frame up here. Here's Arianna Huffington talking about Bill Clinton's performance on Fox News and how he has to make some decisions, and the Democrats have to make some decisions. Oh, that was good.
That was quite an answer. We saw just a part of that. Clinton was also talking about Richard Clarke, a former counterterrorism official, and why
this is how he curts
Chris Wallace hadn't asked Republicans about that. Arianna Huffington, was it unfair for Chris Wallace to ask about Clinton's record on terrorism, and why did he fly off the handle like that?
Well, I don't know what the private arrangements were about what he could talk about and he could not, but frankly, once you go on the television show, you should know if you're the President of the United States or the former President or me or anybody else that you can be asked anything at all. What this may lead to, which could be good news, is that Bill Clinton may wake up to the fact that there is a real battle going on to define who is going to keep America safer, and for him to try to have it both ways, to have Laura Bush do the keynote during his conference as though we are all in this together, to have Rupert Murdoch, Chris Wallace's ultimate box, the fundraiser for his wife. All that stuff is simply not making it as clear and as distinct as it needs to be for the American people. There are two very different views, and there should be, leading up to the 06 election, about who is going to keep America safer. And Bill Clinton needs to decide if he's just a former president or a former Democratic president helping his party define what is at stake in the upcoming election. So,
well said. So, you know, Arianna Huffington there, and just, you know, basically laying it out. Here is, in part, I mean, this discussion, as it were, this interrogation of Bill Clinton by Chris Wallace. And keep in mind, the number of times that Fox News has had on members of the administration, Dick Cheney, on this program, Chris Wallace. Dick Cheney's been on his program 6 times. Don Rumsfeld's been on his program 9 times. Condi Rice has been on his program 23 times. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley has been on his program 4 times. Clinton's been on once. None of those people were ever asked, why did the Bush administration, when they learned, as it was the Bush administration who learned it, when they learned that Osama bin Laden was responsible for the bombing of the USS Cole, why did the Bush administration not go after bin Laden? None of them were ever asked that question. Here's Clinton with Chris Wallace.
And al-Qaeda out of business when you were president. There's a new book out I suspect you've already read, called The Looming Tower. And it talks about the fact that when you pulled troops out of Somalia in 1993, bin Laden said, I have seen the frailty and the weakness and the cowardice of U.S. troops. Then there was the bombing of the embassies in Africa and the attack on the coal.
Okay, let's just
May I just finish the question, yeah. Sir? And after the attack, the book says that bin Laden separated his leaders, spread them around because he expected an attack, and there was no response. I understand that hindsight is always 20/20.
Well, let's talk about it.
But the question is, why didn't you do more, connect the dots, and put them out of business?
All right, let's talk about it. I will answer all those things on the merits, but first I want to talk about the context in which this arises. I'm being asked this on the Fox network. ABC just had a right-wing conservative run. Their little pathway to 9/11, falsely claiming it was based on the 9/11 Commission report, with 3 things asserted against me directly contradicted by the 9/11 Commission report. And I think it's very interesting that all the conservative Republicans who now say I didn't do enough claimed that I was too obsessed with bin Laden. All of President Bush's neocons thought I was too obsessed with bin Laden. They had no meetings on bin Laden for 9 months after I left office.
Now, this is the big point, and he later on in the interview, he says, I haven't criticized President Bush, and I'm not going to begin now. But there's where he says it. From the time in January when the FBI and CIA said, yes, the USS Cole was bombed by bin Laden, January of 2001, and George W. Bush has been appointed president by the Supreme Court. From that time until September of 2001, George W. Bush did absolutely nothing to stop bin Laden, go after bin Laden, because Clinton had been having weekly meetings in the White House. He says, read Richard Clark's book. I mean, his hair was on fire. We were having weekly meetings about this. We hired hitmen to try and take him out. We sent in the CIA to try and take him out. I tried to kill him in Somalia, and the Republicans were all yelling, he's trying to wag the moniker. And for 9 months, they did nothing. For 9 months, they did nothing. And, you know, and then Clinton points out, well, I'll share a little more of this clip with you when we come back from the break, but Clinton points out, you guys haven't been asking these other folks this question. In fact, right now, let's have our progressive pop quiz, for the day. Today's question, how many Bush administration officials has Fox News' Chris Wallace asked about the connection between Osama bin Laden and the USS Cole bombing and the failure of the Bush administration to respond to it? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, which I'll be signing Saturday at Roman's in Pasadena and the Bodie Tree in Hollywood. The answer coming up after the break. 27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, the True People's Radio.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And it's gone, gone, going, gone, everything gone, give a damn. Gone be the birds when they don't want to sing. Gone people, awkward with their things. Gone. See yourself in the mirror, ain't ya? Feel safe cause it looks familiar, but ya. Afraid to open up your soul cause ya. Don't really know who is the person.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. The program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Tom Hartman here with you. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Once again, our question was, how many Bush administration officials has Fox News' Chris Wallace asked about the connection between Osama bin Laden and the bombing of the USS Cole? Even though he had Dick Cheney on 6 times, Don Rumsfeld on 9 times, Condi Rice on 23 times, Stephen Hadley on 4 times, how many of them did he ask, why didn't you guys go after bin Laden when you were the ones who knew that he did the coal? Clinton didn't have proof of it. How many did he ask? Well, congratulations to John Kuhn from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. John Kuhn knew that the correct answer is zero. None. And what happened to our applause, Alex? There we go. Congratulations, John. Good idea. Thank you. Yes, John wins the contest. So here's a little more of Bill Clinton responding to this outrageous loaded question. I believe. There we go.
All the right-wingers who now say I didn't do enough said I did too much. Same people. They were all trying to get me to withdraw from Somalia in 1993 the next day after we were involved in Black Hawk Down, and I refused to do it and stayed 6 months and had an orderly transfer to the United Nations. Okay, now let's look at all the criticisms. Black Hawk Down, Somalia. There is not a living soul in the world who thought Osama bin Laden had anything to do with Black Hawk Down, or was paying any attention to it, or even knew Al-Qaeda was a going concern in October of 93.
No, wait.
Don't tell me this. You asked me why didn't I do more to bin Laden. There was not a living soul. All the people who now criticize me wanted to leave the next day. You brought this up, so you get an answer. Secondly,
bin Laden says...
Bin Laden says
it would have showed the weakness of the United States.
It would have shown the weakness if we'd left right away. But he wasn't involved in that. That's just a bunch of bull. That was about Muhammad Adib, a Muslim warlord, murdering 22 Pakistani Muslim troops. We were all there on a humanitarian mission. We had no mission, none, to establish a certain kind of Somali government or keep anybody out. He was not a religious fanatic. There was no Al-Qaeda.
With respect, if I may.
Yeah, and so, in fact, this brings us to our...
Now, Behind Enemy Lines.
Old segment here. I just got this from the RNC. Just went out to every talk show host in America from RNC Research. The Bill Clinton anti-terror myth fact sheet. Myth. President Bill Clinton said he was besieged by conservative Republicans who thought he was too obsessed with bin Laden. This is what all the cons are going to be saying. And they say, the fact, conservative Republicans praise President Clinton for going after bin Laden. And then they have, oddly, a quote from Julian Alperin in the Washington Post. Eh? Another quote by Julian Alperin in the Washington Post. Another quote by Julian Alperin. In fact, they have 4 quotes from Julian Alperin in the Washington Post. Well, if you go back and you look at the actual speeches on the floor, here's Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Republican senator from Texas. Quote, I supported our original mission, which was humanitarian in nature and limited in scope. I can no longer support a continued United States presence in Somalia because the nature of the mission is now unrealistic and because the scope of our mission is now limitless. Mr. President, it is no small feat for a superpower to accept setback on the world stage, but a step backwards is sometimes the wisest course. I believe that withdrawal is now the more prudent option. Dirk Kempthorne, October 6, 1993, on the Senate floor. If the Somalis are now healthy enough to be fighting us, then it's absolutely time that we go home. GOP Minority Leader Robert Dole, October 5th, 1993, on the Senate floor. He says, I think it is clear to say that the meeting we had earlier with, I don't know how many members there were, 45, 50 senators and half the House of Representatives, the administration is going to be under great pressure to bring the actions in Somalia to a close. Jesse Helms on the Senate floor. The time to get out is now. But those are not the quotes that you're going to find in the RNC talking points that are being distributed to all the right-wing talk show hosts right now. Those are not. This is just incredible. Just incredible. Fact. What, the myth. Well, this is a week when Clinton said no one knew of Al-Qaeda in 1993. Fact, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were well known by the time Clinton was inaugurated. Well, it was right around 93. But this is maybe. I mean, again, if the Republican talking points have any myth, it's just myth. President Clinton said Richard Clark was nonpartisan and loyal to all the presidents he worked for. And then they go in this long campaign of smearing Richard Clark. His book is riddled with inaccuracies, his record marked by glaring national security inconsistencies. Yes, trash the messenger.
Instead of going through 93 and 96,
no, you ask it. You brought it up.
May I ask you a general question and then you can answer? Yeah. The 9/11 Commission, which you talked about, and this is what they did say, not what ABC pretended they said.
What did they say?
They said about you and President Bush, and I quote, "The U.S. government took the threat seriously, but not in the sense of mustering anything like the kind of effort that would be gathered to confront an enemy of the first, second, or even third rank."
First of all, that's not true with us and bin Laden.
Well, I'm talking about the 9/11 Commission.
Let's look at what Richard Clark said. Do you think Richard Clark has a vigorous attitude about bin Laden?
Yes, I do.
You do,
don't
you?
He has a variety of opinions and loyalties,
right.
But yes,
he has a variety of opinions and loyalties now. But let's look at the facts. He worked for Ronald Reagan. He was loyal to him. He worked for George H.W. Bush, he was loyal to him. He worked for me, and he was loyal to me. He worked for President Bush, he was loyal to him. They downgraded him and the terrorist operation. Now, look what he said. Read his book and read his factual assertions. Not opinions, assertions. He said, we took vigorous action after the African embassies. We probably nearly got bin Laden. I authorized... I authorized... I authorized the CIA to get groups together to try to kill him. The CIA was run by George Tenet that President Bush gave the Medal of Freedom to. He said he did a good job setting up all these counterterrorism things. The country never had a comprehensive anti-terror operation until I came there. And if you want to criticize me for one thing, you can criticize me for this. After the cold, I had battle plans drawn to go into Afghanistan, overthrow the Taliban, and launch a full-scale attack search for bin Laden.
Here it is.
But we needed basing rights in Uzbekistan, which we got after 9/11. The CIA and the FBI refused to certify that bin Laden was responsible while I was there. They refused to certify. So that meant I would have had to send a few hundred special forces in helicopters refuel at night. Even the 9/11 Commission didn't do that. Now, the 9/11 Commission was a political document, too. All I'm asking is, anybody wants to say I didn't do enough, you read Richard Clark.
Do you think you did enough, sir?
No, because I didn't get him.
Right.
But at least I tried. That's the difference in me and some, including...
Me and some. He's getting, he's like, I'm not going to go after Bush, but it's some of these guys.
All the right wingers that are attacking me now, they ridicule me for trying. They had 8 months to try. They did not try.
They had 8 months to try. So this is he's talking about Bush, but he won't name him.
I tried. So I tried and failed. When I failed, I left a comprehensive anti-terror strategy, and the best guy in the country, Dick Clark, who got demoted. So you did Fox's bidding on this show. You did your nice little conservative hit job on me. What I want to know...
Wait a minute, sir.
No,
that's a legitimate question.
it was a perfectly legitimate question, but I want to know how many people in the Bush administration asked this question of. I want to know how many people...
There you go. How many people in the Bush administration have you asked this question of? Well, let's see what Chris Wallace has to say.
The Bush administration, you asked, why didn't you do anything about the coal? I want to know how many people you asked, why did you fire Dick Clark? I want to know how many people you asked.
We asked. Did you ever watch Fox News Sunday, sir?
I don't believe you asked them that.
We asked plenty of questions.
You didn't ask that, did you? Tell the truth.
Did you ever
ask that? You set this meeting up because you're going to get a lot of criticism from your viewers because Rupert Murdoch supported my work on climate change. And you came here under false pretenses and said that you spent half the time talking about, you said you spent half the time talking about what we get out there to raise.
And then, you know, and then they get into this kind of, he said, she said about, you know, who's going to be and how long is it going to be. But, and the bottom line is, and this should be part of the national debate, why did Bush fail to protect us when he knew that bin Laden was behind the USS Cole bombing? And when he had over 56 specific warnings that bin Laden was coming to get us on our own grounds, on our own territory? Why did Bush fail to protect us on 9/11? And the bigger question in my mind is, why are the Democrats not asking that question out loud, in the media, out in front, as vigorously as possible, over and over and over again? Where are the Democrats on this? I mean, here's Bill Clinton doing it by inference. It's just mind-boggling to me. We'll be back with your calls and more on this and other topics right after this break. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a fair election.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Helping you with the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, 51 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Victoria with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, we've been talking about the Clinton interview here. How about we take some calls together?
Oh, let's.
Okay. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live and on the air. Hey, Rick. No, Rick. Okay, we'll come back. Let's see here. Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I thought it was so interesting that Clinton yesterday, he just barely under his breath said the words dog, and you know that was such a big thing.
Wag the dog. Yeah, wag the dog. Oh yeah, they weren't just yelling wag the dog. They were yelling wag the Monica, and then they came out with that book and the movie about that. Good point, Bill. Victoria, your take on it?
You know, I think that he decided when he was invited to do this, he knew that he was going to be surprised by this, and I think he decided to himself, okay, I'm going to be surprised. Do I just want to go for it and take the opportunity that I didn't get on September the 11th?
Yeah, and he did.
And he did, and am I going to lose my temper? Yeah, I am. And do I give a bleep? No, I don't.
Yeah, I think it was a brilliant performance. Ken in Sacramento, California, your thoughts?
Well, what I was going to say was I've been waiting for Clinton to do this for the last couple of years, and for me, this is the bellwether moment for the Democratic Party. We have the president coming out and clarifying with a public record exactly what went on. And if the Democrats in power at the federal level don't take advantage of this door being open, then I think this party has been shown for being the gutless bastards that they are. And at that point, I think it's time to really seriously move on from the Democrats.
Or get hyperactive and infiltrate and take over the Democrats, one or the other. And frankly, I'm in favor of the latter. But Victoria, your thoughts?
I don't think it's possible for people to move on. There's nowhere to move on to.
Yeah. Now, how's this being played in Washington, D.C. right now? What's the buzz inside the Beltway?
It's being played. I would say with some caution by the Democrats, actually.
Now I just got a 7-page memo that went out to every talk show host in America. 8-page, yeah, 7-page memo from RNC Research, an RNC Research briefing, the Bill Clinton anti-terror myth fact. And it just takes apart what Clinton said yesterday. And it does it in ways that are just openly, wantonly deceptive. It's incredible. But every talk show host in the country today is going to be saying, see, we proved that Clinton was weak on terror. I mean, they're going to turn up to down. They're going to turn black to white.
Absolutely.
It's incredible. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with me and Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News. Hey, Rick.
Well, I saw the interview with Chris Wallace had with Bill Clinton. And, of course, I don't think Mr. Wallace is particularly a conservative, you know, even as Alan Combs is now. But he does work for Fox. And as you say, Fox, you know, pretty much is the pro-Bush network. And
he knows who writes his paychecks.
Yeah, these talk show hosts, like you mentioned, they get these RNC talking points, you know. And, of course, I guess they're either afraid the Democrats are going to make gains in Congress this fall, or perhaps they think Bill's fronting for Hillary right now. Now, I like you, Tom, I'm a little wary about Hillary being the nominee. But I have to think that just about any Democrat would be a better...
Yeah, but that's a whole other thing. What was your take on Bill
Clinton? Well, he probably did get a little too angry for an ex-president, but I guess he felt strongly about this. And you know,
that's interesting, you know, because I didn't sense anger in that at all. I mean, I sense righteous indignation. Victoria, what was your take on it?
Oh, I sensed righteous indignation and anger. I thought both were going on. I thought it was a righteous anger, but I did get the impression that he was angry.
Yeah, you certainly see the anger coming out when George W. Bush is asked a tough question. Isn't it amazing how nobody talks about that?
No, it's okay for President Bush apparently to be angry.
But it's not okay for Bill Clinton.
No. And I've noticed also that since Bill Clinton's left office, there's been a kind of, and this is a general thing, not by the right wing, there's been a general sort of fuzzifying, cuddlifying, and furrifying of him to make him into a snuggly toy, kind of like they did with Martin Luther King, and to make him cuddly. And now suddenly everybody's saying, oh, he isn't. Oh, he's got teeth. Oh,
yeah.
He's tough.
Yeah. What are the prospects? What are the possibilities? For example, here we've got this bill now, that this so-called compromise that these three Republicans have come up with, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, John Warner, that would essentially do away with habeas corpus in the United States. I mean, you know, something that goes back to 1215. They do away with it and codify torture. At what point do the Democrats stand up and say, we're going to be tough too?
I mean, frankly, goodness only knows, because this is the week for them to stand up if there ever was a week. They've got one more week. You've got Senator Arlen Specter holding hearings today on some aspects of the terrorism bill, and don't ask me which because I get confused. But he's ticked off enough about this deal that he doesn't think it's straight enough. And we know that he does tend to roll over, but nevertheless, he's having hearings.
Yeah, but he's rolled over every single time so far up to this point. But nonetheless, you can still...
But the Democrats aren't having hearings.
They don't have the power to. They don't have the ability to.
Well, they could have one in a closet somewhere.
Yeah, right. So call your member of Congress, 866-808-0065, toll free, 866-808-0065. Call your senators and tell them stop the torture bill, stop the end of habeas corpus. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thanks for being with us, Victoria. Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. I already told you that, didn't I? Yeah, well, we're still working on it. We still are. Coming up in the next hour, we'll continue with this and other news of the day, as well as Alec Dubrow and Clara Jeffrey with Mother Jones.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Is Bill Clinton slapping down Chris Wallace, or is it the other way around? I'm telling you, the Republicans are out there with their talking points, and they're spreading this thing around like absolute crazy. I mean, it's just consider dueling realities. Okay? The Republicans sent out to all the talk show hosts in America, myself included, the Bill Clinton anti-terror myth fact. They are so good at this. I'm telling you, there's not an event that happens that I don't get an email from RNC Research. I don't get them from the Democratic Party. Harry Reid's office sends out some pretty good stuff from time to time, but nothing like this. I mean, they must have an army of people who do nothing but just go back and look through old news stories and whatever they can find, some kind of archive or whatever. For example, myth. President Clinton says he was besieged by conservative Republicans who thought he was too obsessed with Osama bin Laden. This is what he said on Fox News yesterday. And then the Republicans say, the fact, conservative Republicans praised President Clinton for going after bin Laden. Yeah. And then they quote, for example, the Washington Post, most lawmakers from both parties were quick to rally behind Clinton in a deluge of public statements and appearances, a marked contrast to the relatively sparse and chilly reception that greeted his statement on the Lewinsky matter. It's a whole bunch of ellipses in there, a whole bunch of dot, dot, dots. And I don't have the original quote, so I don't know what the Republicans deleted from this to change its meaning. But I guarantee you there's a bunch of stuff in there. They're quoting Gingrich and Trent Lott and all this stuff back in 1998. On the other hand, and then they're saying, you know, well, the Republicans didn't call for him to pull out of Somalia. Yeah. And then but on the other hand, you have the actual quotes, not from the Republicans. This actually came from Salon, Post and Salon. Quotes from Senator K. Bailey Hutchinson, Republican, October 6, 1993. From Dirk Kempthorne, Republican, October 6, 93. Bob Dole, October 5, 1993. Jesse Helms, October 6, 93. And then Clinton saying, no, let's not leave Somalia tomorrow. He says, this is October 8, 1993. He says, and make no mistake about it, if we were to leave Somalia tomorrow, other nations would leave too. Chaos would resume. The relief effort would stop, and starvation soon would return. That knowledge has led us to continue our mission. If we leave them now, those embers will reignite into flames, and people will die again. If we stay a short while longer and do the right things, and he stayed only 6 months, we have a reasonable chance of cooling off the embers and getting other firefighters to take our place. So now we face a choice. Do we leave when the job gets tough? Or when the job is well done? Do we invite the return of mass suffering, or do we leave in a way that gives the Somalis a decent chance to survive? Recently, General Colin Powell said this about our choices in Somalia. Because things get difficult, you don't cut and run. You work the problem and try to find a correct solution. So let us finish the work we set out to do. Let us demonstrate to the world, as generations of Americans have done before us, that when Americans take on a challenge, they do the job right. John Kerry, floor speech, 1993, says, I'm jarred by the extraordinary sense of panic that seems to be rushing through this deliberative body and by the strident cries for a quick exit by the Republicans. Super reporter Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. Not clear whether the critics can assemble sufficient votes to pass a law requiring Mr. Clinton to stop the operation. This is providing aid, humanitarian aid in Somalia. Mr. Christopher, one of the Republican lawmakers, said the United States wanted to withdraw its forces when possible, but not before our job is done of providing some security. Excuse me. Christopher in the Bush administration. It's Vietnam all over again, said Senator Ernest Hollings of South Carolina, who's in a group of conservatives calling for quick withdrawal from Somalia. John McCain said, we should tell Mr. Adid that we want the Americans back, otherwise he will pay sooner or later. Then we should come home. It's amazing how the Republicans are trying to absolutely reinvent history. They're just reinventing history. it causes me to frankly long for the days when we had presidents who talked about bringing us together and talked about human rights at the same time that this is going on. Frankly, what I think is the biggest issue out there is that John McCain, John Warner, and Lindsey Graham have forged this so-called compromise that says that they're going to let Bush off the hook, that he cannot be prosecuted when he leaves office for violations of the War Crimes Act in the U.S. When 9/11 happened, Bush started with the bellicose rhetoric, the I'm a tough guy, I'm a bully, we're going to kick your butt rhetoric. And it played well to part of America. But I have to tell you, it's not the rhetoric of statesmanship. Remember when our presidents sought to bring the world together?
We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
To those human rights to which we have always been committed. And what does Bush say? Ah, to hell with the human rights. The Constitution is just a piece of paper. Habeas corpus? Well, yeah, it was a good idea in 1215. It was a good idea in 1658 when King John, you know, when they passed the second habeas corpus law. It was a good idea in 1789 when they incorporated it into the Constitution with the ratification of the Bill of Rights. It was a fine idea back then, the 4th through the 8th Amendments. But now we don't need that. I remember when presidents said, not only will we have human rights at home, but we're going to work for human rights all over the world. And the rest of the world, as a result, wanted to be like us. Instead of having presidents who behaved like bullies, like street thugs, we had presidents who talked like statesmen.
To those new states whom we welcome to the ranks of the free, we pledge our word that one form of colonial control shall not have passed away merely to be replaced by a far more iron tyranny. We shall not always expect to find them supporting our view, but we shall always hope to find them strongly supporting their own freedom, and to remember that in the past, those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside.
I think that's good advice for George W. Bush right now. Kennedy continued.
To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe, struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich.
And that's the absolute bottom line, right? And that was the absolute bottom line for Kennedy. And instead, Bush comes along and says, you're either with us or against us. You're either good or you're evil. If you're a nice guy, okay. If you're not, we're going to bomb us. We're going to bomb you, right?
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. He said, if you're with us, you're evil. If you're against us, you're good. Right? Isn't that, am I getting this right?
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Yeah, okay. And of course, the classic.
When we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
I mourn the loss of civil politics in the United States. It's just such a tragedy. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. The Tom Hartman Program. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. The website, the number of subpoenas. A subpoena is a legal document where you are forced to testify. Right? You are well, not always forced, but you are called to testify. Or produce information. The number of subpoenas that were issued by Congress to the White House between 1995 and the year 2000, 1,050. Over 1,050 investigations into the Clinton administration by the Republicans in Congress. Over 1,050 of them in a four-year period. That's 250 a year on average. You consider Congress doesn't even meet 250 days a year. That's more than one a day for every day that Congress was in session from 1995, the end of 1995, through the beginning of the year 2000. The number of subpoenas issued to the White House between 2000 and 2005? Zero. Zero. Now, some would say, oh, well, that's because, the Republicans control Congress and the White House, and they, when the one party controls both the House and the Senate and the White House, they don't investigate themselves. Not true. 1922, President Harding, Republican, was president. Republican Senator Robert La Follette, Sr., in 1922, sent a subpoena to the White House. They wanted to talk with Albert Fell, the Secretary of the Interior, about the word that they were hearing that he was leasing gas supplies in Wyoming to his friends. It became the Teapot Dome scandal. It almost brought down Harding's presidency, and yet the Republicans continued to investigate it. This is when the Republicans controlled both the House, the Senate, and the presidency. 1922, they investigated themselves. In 1941, when the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency. Franklin Roosevelt was president. Harry Truman was a member of the Senate. And he sent subpoenas to the White House saying, we want to know what's going on with waste, fraud, and mismanagement in the war effort. It led to a series of prosecutions. Now, Roosevelt could have looked bad in this. Instead, Roosevelt got out in front of it. He said, I'm not going to allow a single war millionaire to be made on my watch. I support Harry Truman's investigations of my administration. which is where Harding made the mistake, the Republican Harding back in 1922. He kind of tried to minimize it, and then finally at the end he said, okay, take Albert Fell off to prison. In 1966, the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the president. LBJ was president, 1966. Who was it who chaired the Foreign Relations Committee and held high-profile hearings into whether or not Vietnam was an appropriate war? It was the Democrat, William Fulbright, the Fulbright Commission. I mean, this is what is happening right now is absolutely abnormal. It is not the way that America has typically, traditionally, and appropriately, functionally been run. It just is not the case. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good morning, Tom. A perfect segue with Victoria. A representative by the name of Heather Wilson, she revised a bill last week.
Heather Wilson is a Weasley Republican from New Mexico.
Okay, and she revised it to Bush's liking on domestic surveillance, but she ended up adding a little piece, and this is the piece, to allow wiretapping on America in the event of, quote, imminent, unquote, terrorist attack.
Right.
That it, there it is.
It's already, you know, he already has that authority under the FISA law. All he has to do is start wiretapping and within 3 days go to a judge and say, here's the evidence that there's an imminent attack.
Well, see, the two bills that they're going to be, it's the military tribunals and FISA are the bills up
right
in the House right now. And the second one, Tom, it was out of the Washington Post, and it was interesting listening to you quote the Post. And it's on covering the rights of terrorist suspects, and it's on the detention camps. But that phrase is, the beginning, it says the White House and dissident Senate Republicans. There's the word, and we talked about that last week.
And they were posturing as if they were dissidents, but the bottom line is that they're not. These guys just rolled over and said, okay, George, whatever you want, you can have it. It's just fine. Call your senators now, 866-808-0065, and raise some hell about this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Telling the truth to multinational corporations, I would really rather you didn't know about it. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. Interesting, at the top of Think Progress, Newsweek's latest cover by geographical region. Cover of Newsweek in Europe. It's got a picture of a Mujahideen guy, or somebody who looks like it, you know, holding a rocket launcher. And it says, losing Afghanistan. The Asia version, losing Afghanistan, same guy. The Latin American version of Newsweek, losing Afghanistan, same guy. The U.S. version, my life in pictures. Huh? This is incredible. Let's in just a moment, we're going to be speaking with Clara Jeffrey of MotherJones.com, but first, let's find out what's going on with the occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight and to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Following a security incident and other developments in Iraq reported by Reuters on Monday as of 10:30 GMT, in Jurf al-Shakar, mortar rounds and a suicide truck bomber targeting a police station killed 3 policemen and wounded 10 in that small town. Other police sources put the toll at 2 killed and 5 wounded by mortar rounds. In Najaf, gunmen killed a translator working for U.S. forces on Sunday night. In Baiji, police found the decapitated head of a police lieutenant, Samir Hazim, who was kidnapped on Sunday. 9 other severed heads were found on Saturday. Near Baiji, the corpse of an Iraqi soldier who had been shot dead was found on Sunday on the main road between Baiji and Haditha. In Balad, an Iraqi soldier died on Monday of wounds sustained from small arms fire. In Yathrib, a mortar round landed near a house on Sunday, killing a man and wounding his 10-year-old daughter. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army arrested 12 armed men who posed as Iraqi soldiers and carried out killings in the western Amiriya district of Baghdad. And also in Baghdad, the Iraqi army arrested Zahir Kasan Saleh, a leader of the Ansar al-Sunni militant group and a member of his association in the Abu Ghraib district in western Baghdad, according to defense ministry spokesman. Also, Parliament agreed to set up a committee of 27 members to draft amendments to the Constitution, part of a deal to break a deadlock that would also allow to create autonomous regions after 18 months. Members of the committee will be named on Tuesday. That perhaps the only hopeful sign out of the whole thing. Clara Jeffrey is with us with Mother Jones Magazine, motherjones.com, the website. Clara, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
This is our best of the rest of the news segment, where on Mondays we take a look at the week past and the week coming. Clara, what do you see as the really big stories of the last week, both in general and as you've covered it in Mother Jones?
Well, one of the big stories of last week, which didn't get that much attention outside of the Washington Post where it first ran, but was the article by Rajiv Shandakasaran, who's the assistant managing editor there. And this is an excerpt from his book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City. And basically he talks about how the Coalition for Provisional Authority gave out key Iraq reconstruction jobs to people who were good soldiers for the GOP but utterly incompetent for the job at hand. And those hires were vetted by Jim O'Byrne in the DOD. He's the husband of Katie O'Byrne, who's a conservative commentator for the National Review. And they quizzed potential hires not on their skill set for the job needed, but things like, did you support George W. Bush in 2000? What are your views on Roe v. Wade? And this kind of thing. So they handed out jobs that are incredibly important to people who just had no business getting them, like the daughter of Michael Ledeen, Simone Ledeen, who was a young MBA student, was tapped to manage Iraq's budget, $3 billion budget. She was, I think, 26 years old. A 24-year-old who had never worked in finance but had applied for a job at the White House was sent to reopen Baghdad Stock Exchange. And a guy who was a community health director for Republican governor of Michigan, John Engler, was sent to overhaul Iraq's rehabilitation system, health service system. And he basically just wanted to put in a bunch of privatization schemes and wanted to make Iraqis pay for health care and, you know, just sort of this panoply of ideas that really had no business being tried out in a country that had just been, you know, bombed to king and come.
In a real way, though, Clara Jeffrey, this is horrific on its face. I mean, this is what almost brought down the Harding administration, you know, Albert Fell, the Teapot Dome scandal. This is what Franklin Roosevelt would not tolerate in his administration and what Harry Truman made his name in the U.S. Senate investigating.
Exactly.
As a senator. And, Democrats investigating Democrats. But at the same time that Warren Harding, who, even though he was a conservative Republican, still believed in government, and certainly Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman believed in government, those guys would have viewed this as basically a sin. But the fact of the matter is that the Republicans who are in power right now, the Bush administration, they subscribe to the old Reagan notion that government is a fundamental evil. As Reagan said,
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And therefore they view government as something to be either destroyed or exploited.
I mean, that's definitely a part of it. I mean, these guys that went over to reconstruct Iraq seemed to believe Grover Norquist's statement that he'd like to, you know, turn government into something so small you could drown it into a bathtub.
Yeah.
But basically it was that, you know, it's not just that their ideology is is, you know, abhorrent, but it's also that ideology really shouldn't have come into it at this point. When you're talking about a country that's had 17 of its 23 ministries destroyed, you know, you just need to get things up and running. And then down the road, you can think about, you know, how to, whether or not Iraq's health system should be privatized.
But ideology already did come into it. I mean, we rewrote their constitution.
That's right. This
is the conservatives' attempt to prove that Harry Truman was wrong when he, you know, gave strong defense for labor and things like that, and national health care systems to Japan and Germany, helping them rewrite their constitutions. These guys wanted to create a neocon utopian state. They thought they were going to do it.
Right. They thought they were going to do it, and they were also, you know, practicing the good old political game of just handing out favors to friends.
Yeah, crony capitalism. And what do you see coming down the road here, Clara Jeffrey, MotherJones.com? We're talking about Clara Jeffrey, the editor of Mother Jones Magazine.
I think, you know, that this story that broke over the weekend about how the National Intelligence Estimate, I mean, that's a consensus document put together by the United States' 22 intelligence agencies, saying that the Iraq War has made terror worse. It has increased global Islamic radicalism, that it's radicalized copycat groups that no longer directly report to Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda. So even if for some, you know, even by some miracle were you to get rid of Al-Qaeda, it wouldn't matter as much because they're just groups operating on their own behest. That report got leaked this weekend. And, you know, it was interesting watching Majority Leader Bill Frist, who was saying, even though this report has been available to the Senate and certainly the Senate leadership since April, he was claiming that he hadn't read it, which is, you know, a very old game. Mm-hmm. And it's worth noting, too, that just a couple weeks ago during the 9/11 anniversary, the Bush administration selectively produced documents that hyped the administration successes, you know, in taking out the top tier of Al-Qaeda, which A, isn't really true, and B, as this National Intelligence Estimate reports, isn't really relevant anymore anyway. I mean, because we invaded Iraq, we've made Islamic radical terrorism much worse, and we've made a lot more enemies, basically.
Yeah, here's Bush trying to hype the opposite of this before the fact.
You know, I've heard this theory about, you know, everything was just fine until we arrived, and then, you know, kind of, the you know, stir up the hornet's nest theory.
Well, I
mean, it just doesn't hold water as far as I'm concerned. The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Right.
It's astounding, isn't it?
The terrorists did attack us. Those terrorists did not come from Iraq or have any direct connection to Iraq or to Saddam Hussein, as we now know so well. So we had the terrorists who were attacking us, and then we created a bunch more new ones.
Yeah.
You know, that's just basic math.
That's just basic math, yeah. And then the other thing, it seems to me, is the other big one is these three Republicans rolling over and saying, okay, we'll do away with habeas corpus. I mean, this is huge. This is huge.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was really a shame this week. I mean, it was really admirable of Senator McCain and Warner and Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, and Colin Powell, and, you know, on and on, George Shultz and 53 generals to stand up and, you know, say we want the Geneva Conventions honored. We believe that if we undermine them, that we're putting our own troops at risk. And unfortunately, the administration rolled these guys.
Yeah. Yeah, they just totally flipped over and said, okay, no problem, George, you will never be prosecuted for war crimes. We'll make sure of that. And I think that's really at the core of it.
It is, and I mean, I think that the Democrats need to now join those Republicans and really push for honoring the Geneva Convention, the letter and the spirit.
Speak out loudly. Clara Jeffrey, MotherJones.com. Thank you, Clara.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
19 miles to Baghdad. What have I become? New York's got snow in April. I can't locate the sun.
And welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. It's the Tom Hartman radio program coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Alec Dubrow is with us. He's the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association. Their website, ILCA Online, ILCAOnline.org. And Alec, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom, and let me start off by congratulating you on that piece you have at TomPaine.com. You were doing our work for us.
Well, thank you. About the importance of labor.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's actually an excerpt from my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It.
It's very good. You should consider becoming a writer.
yeah, there you go. And I've got a new piece up on Common Dreams. Just went up 5 minutes ago, commondreams.org, here today about Bush trying to, the Republicans rolling over. It's all about habeas corpus, which has got nothing to do with labor, so I'll rant about it some other time because you and I are going to talk about labor here for a minute. Back in 1964, LBJ invited a bunch of editors to the White House for a reception and a talk. The Labor Department worked with you guys to help train union members to become communicators. I mean, there was cooperation between the Department of Labor, which is supposed to look out for the interests of labor, and the White House, and organized labor. What happened?
I don't know what happened, but Ronald Reagan happened, essentially. But it's extraordinary, the contrast between what was happening back at that point and now. I found these notes in our files. I couldn't find a transcript of it, but I looked it up, and Johnson routinely had labor people to the White House. I mean, I found where he had created the Labor Advisory Council to the President's Committee on Equal Employment. And he's there telling him, you've always sought to help protect the underdog, you've struggled to improve further the conditions of the American worker until he has the highest standard of living in history, and it is still not enough.
Cynics, Alec, would say, well, labor was one of the constituencies of LBJ. That's not all that different.
Well, it's very interesting.
Than George W. Bush inviting Halliburton into the White House.
I know, but this is the same Lyndon Johnson who, as a congressman, voted for Taft-Hartley and then voted to pass it over Truman's veto. So the truth is, it isn't necessarily that we had more sympathetic people, it's that we had more power. And as the power declined, then the new conservative movement sought to push people out.
That's interesting. I had no idea Lyndon Johnson voted in favor of Taft-Hartley.
That's right. Well, it passed over Truman's veto, so it must have gotten two-thirds or whatever it is, two-thirds, yeah, to pass.
Yeah, to override Truman's veto.
And I think almost all Southerners voted against it. But in any case, it was just very different times. Right now, the Bush administration and Congress have just frozen labor out. I just found out that the AFL-CIO president, John Sweeney, has never been invited to the Bush White House. Never. Nor have any of the other titled officers.
Never, ever.
Ever.
Is there any precedent for that since
I don't
labor?
Believe so.
Since
I don't 1954? Believe there was any precedent.
I'm sure Eisenhower invited labor to the White House.
Oh,
he was a friend of labor, by
invited
and large.
Labor. Nixon invited labor. I think George Bush the first did.
Well, here's a cynical comment, but a funny one. Nixon certainly invited labor. Jimmy Hoffa came in and gave him $500,000 cash bribe to drop the Sun Valley land to prosecution against him, which kind of brings up the checkered past of this whole thing. But nonetheless,
well, I'm not going to whitewash history. Yeah.
No, but and that's really that's part of the good news, actually, is that labor has cleaned up its act since then. It's this kind of cycle of what happens when people get power and it becomes corrosive.
Yep.
We're talking with Alec Dubrow. He's the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAOnline.org, the website. And one of the
actually, it's SEIU, I believe, Service Employees International Union, which is not part of the AFL-CIO. It's part of the Change to Win Coalition.
Correct.
Is running a lot of advertising claiming that they're the fastest growing union in the United States, that the union movement is coming back, that they're leading the forefront of it. I'm accepting that on its face is true, and I'm assuming that you do too. Is labor making a comeback even in the face of all of these challenges that the Bush administration is throwing in front of it?
Well, I think the short answer is yes and no. I mean, it's a broad movement, and in parts of it where there's industrial decline, there is a decline, and
sure,
it's not coming back, although things could change. But in other areas of the economy and the workforce, there is growth, not only in SEIU, but in some of the AFL-CIO unions that are organizing in the same areas, particularly such as healthcare and education.
The things that can't be offshored.
The things that can't be offshored, and yes, there is growth, and you're about to see that the political power of labor is still a potent force, which is why, even though in decline, it's still despised by the right wing.
Yeah. Well, and also, labor is democracy in the workplace, and the right wing is democracy. So.
It's always been needed for that. Yes, indeed.
Alec Dubrow, ILCA Online, ilcaonline.org, the website. Alec, thanks for being with us
today. Okay, Tom.
Great speaking with you. Tomorrow, on the Tom Hartman program, I'll be debating nationally syndicated conservative talk show host Michael Medved. How much torture is too much torture? Former weapons inspector Scott Ritter is here about his fact-finding mission in Iran. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, your radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.